Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. I'm doing great.
It's a very dreep day in Edinburgh, which is the Scots word for grey and rainy. But we are very lucky to have a very special guest today. Frank, you want to introduce our special guest?
Absolutely. We have Alexi Garrett here, who's a friend of ours from the University of Virginia. And Alexi is a PhD student who is in Britain at the moment doing some research relating to her PhD. And we thought we'd invite her in for a chat. For people who thought we might talk about the whistleblowing report and Ukraine and all of that, I have a feeling we'll have time to do that in the future. I think that story's not going away. So we'll probably do that next week or in the future. So, Alexi, welcome to Edinburgh.
Thank you very much, Frank and David.
Yep. Is this your first time in town?
It absolutely is, yes, even though I'm leaving tonight.
But
yes, I got here Monday and have been doing research at the National Archives here of Scotland. And it's been a really good time looking at kind of some Scottish merchants that were kind of part of the grandfatherly family of the woman I'm researching.
Well, we'll get to your research here or what you've been doing while you've been in Britain. Could you just tell us and tell our listeners about your project? What's your PhD on?
Sure. So my PhD is entitled Single Women and the Business of Slavery in Early National Virginia. So I'm looking at how especially elite single women who would be falling under the femme sole legal status of the time, so whether that means they're widowed or just never married, but I'm looking at how they are using their own enslaved people in proto-industrial businesses at this time in Virginia. And so this is an interesting time in Virginia because the tobacco boom is over. And
so what are the dates? Right.
So the dates are basically like 1790s to kind of 1830s, 40s, depending on each woman's life. So I have three main characters that I can talk about. So, but before that, I was just going to say the tobacco boom in Virginia is over, and we have the growth of cities at this time for the very first time, like Richmond and Alexandria in particular. And so there's kind of this proto-industrial revolution starting. It's just not in full effect yet in Virginia. So yeah, the three main characters I'm looking at are on a spectrum of labor when it comes to management. So I'm looking at kind of women's management of businesses as labor. So I'm looking at this spectrum, and on one end is Martha Washington. She's probably the most well-known character of who I'm looking at. And she obviously is a wealthy slave owner, landowner, wife of George Washington and her second marriage. So I'm looking at her widowhood periods from the first and second husband and seeing what decisions she makes with her land and enslaved people. Looking at those periods, but also comparing them to her periods of marriage to see if she's making different choices and if that's going to come out with like a gendered argument about women's management or not when they're single versus married. The single versus married aspect is important because legally back then, if you were a woman and you got married, your entire legal entity is subsumed under your husband's name. Now, women are running businesses while married or unmarried, right? But when creditors come calling, then legally everything is under the man's name. So that does not change until the Married Women's Property Acts, which are passed state by state. The first one was in Mississippi. I don't think Virginia's was until like after the Civil War. But what these Married Women's Property Acts do is say, okay, even if a woman gets married now, she's her own legal identity. She can keep her own business profits. She can keep her own earnings, keep her own property, even if she's married. What's interesting about the Married Women's Property Acts, they are not being passed for some growing proto-feminist movement.
So I was going to ask you, Mississippi
not
was the
all.
First.
Right,
so
right. I don't know why Mississippi was the first, to be quite honest. But no, it has nothing to do with kind of women's rights. Mm. What's fascinating is that this is kind of the time of capitalism that is intensifying in the nation. And of course, with more kind of capitalism, you have more debts, right? And you have more fluctuation with the market. And so you have more families across the nation experiencing kind of booms and busts and debts more. And so, you know, back when women were subsumed under the husband, let's say that husband got into some debt. So his creditors come calling. Well, he could ruin that entire family because the creditors could also take the wife's goods and the wife's assets because it's now the husband's, right? But if women and men are separate legal entities under these Married Women Property Acts. Let's say, again, the husband gets in a debt, creditors come calling, they can only take his property. And so the woman's property is safe, meaning the family assets are safe. And so it's actually to protect the family unit from creditors. Right, so this really has more to do with economic change in the nation than cultural or social change with women.
Interesting. Yeah. How did you, you mentioned Martha Washington. Oh, yes, who were the other two characters?
Yes. So Martha Washington was obviously the most well-known. And then after that, I have a woman named Anne Henry Christian, and she's one of Patrick Henry's siblings. And so Honor Sachs has written about her in Home Rule, which is great. And I'm looking at her during her 4 years of widowhood. She and her husband, she's also kind of earlier in the time period, but she and her husband moved out to the then Kentucky frontier. He was a kind of a colonial elite from Virginia, served in the Revolutionary War, was Patrick Henry's friend. They got married, moved out to the frontier, and owned a salt mine. And of course, salt's really important out there. We don't have refrigeration. So what's fascinating about the salt mine is that they own it, but poor whites as well as free blacks will rent out certain parts of the salt mine, and then that's how they make their profit, is actually from rents. So anyway, so I'm looking at her and her widowhood because she was responsible for paying off all of her husband's debts after he died from an Indian attack. So in 1786, and so it was up to her to kind of figure out how this business ran and how to pay off the debts to many debtors and to keep the business running and out of profit, and she did so, which is very impressive. And then my final character is actually the main character of the dissertation, and she's not she's someone that no one would know. I don't think anyone's really written about her. Her name's Catherine Flood McCall. What's interesting about her is that she never got married, despite many suitors throughout her life. And the reason she had many suitors is because she was from an elite family, and she was the largest female slave owner in Essex County, Virginia for over 20 years. And this is kind of at the turn of the century, so around the 1800s or early 1800s. And she is living in Tappahannock with her father. Her father's Archibald McCall, and he was he was from Glasgow, and he was from a very kind of famous Glaswegian merchant family. And that's why I was here in Glasgow and Edinburgh looking at Catherine's grandpa, so Archibald's dad, and kind of seeing what kind of merchant he was here. But so Archibald moved to Virginia, married an elite American Virginian woman, had two children, two girls. Wife died in childbirth of the second girl. And then they fled during the American Revolution because he was a suspected loyalist, and indeed he was. So he fled, and then the other daughter died, and so then it was only Archibald and Catherine left. So Catherine was raised in boarding schools in London and Scotland, and then they had to petition in order to come back to Virginia after the American Revolutionary War. Luckily, his cousin George McCall was there kind of keeping an eye on the property, but ultimately did have to petition. Did petition, came back, was successful, and then Catherine had many suitors, never married. She always said, oh, I couldn't leave my dear old dad. I'm the only family he has left. And turns around and founds two nail manufactories, one in Alexandria and one in Richmond. So the Alexandria one was founded in 1796, and then the Richmond one was founded in 1805. And so as far as I can tell, she's the only female firm manager of a blacksmith or nail manufacturing type of shop in Richmond and Virginia or in Alexandria at this time. So I'm very interested in her because I think she her life and her story have much to offer us in the way of thinking about how women perform management over enslaved people who are working in her nail manufacturing shops, how women hire out or rent out, as we know, slaves for these enterprises, how they manage people, how they manage the white overseers at the sites of labor. And so I'm interested in her life story, but also just what it looks like to be a woman in a man's proto-industrial world in Virginia at this time.
So how did you come on to this topic?
You can thank my advisor for that. So when I came into graduate school, I knew I wanted to work on women in early America broadly construed, but it had been a couple years since undergrad, so I was pretty flexible, pretty open to whatever project. And he found this, it was scanned online, but the Library of Virginia had this court case where this woman, Catherine Flood McCall, was getting sued. And this court case had over 1,000 documents in it. And he said, here's a woman. See what you can find here. And I was like, great, okay. This is my time period. This is a woman. We can figure out her life through this court case. And so that actually turned into my master's essay, and that was looking at how Catherine was kind of managing the Richmond Enterprise in particular.
And, how rich were those court documents?
Extremely rich, yeah. Unfortunately, the documents I don't have on the McCalls are their like actual business ledgers, like business accounts. But in this court case, it's fascinating. So basically, what you just need to know about the court case is that she had hired a family friend to work as the manager in her Alexandria firm, or the nail manufacturer in Alexandria. Then she sold it to him. Then she founded the Richmond one and kept going with the Richmond one. Then that man, Stuart, died, and he had a lot of debts. And so creditors for him came after her. Because she was a very rich woman, but also they claimed that he was still working under her at the Alexandria Enterprise. And so all these documents are trying to prove, no, I sold it to Stuart. Don't come after me for debts. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, because she did not make a public announcement that this was now owned by someone else, I think they were able to get some money out of her. So didn't go so well for her, but she's rich, so I think she was fine at the end of the day. But yeah, so what was your question?
Well, we started with how did you get onto this topic?
Oh, that's how I got on that topic. Yes, so what's interesting about the court case, most of the documents are letters between her and William Stuart. Mm. And so most of them are ultimately William's letters to her, but I do have some letters from her to William. And what's interesting is that even though she's living away from the site of production, she's living in Tappahannock, she does kind of come into town, but she doesn't really visit the actual site of labor. Hmm. But she knows the enslaved people who work there intimately. She warns Stuart about certain enslaved people who might run away. Oh, she says George might run away. Lo and behold, a couple months later, she takes out an ad in the Richmond newspaper, George has run away. So she knows her enslaved people intimately. She also, he also, William Stuart, can't spend a dime without asking her. He's asking her if he can spend money on a new bed that he can sleep in, right?
Is that because he's legally constrained or he's just dependent, just his personal idiosyncrasies?
I think it's because it's her, I mean, he's getting paid, obviously, a salary, but it's her investments and her funding that that are literally furnishing the business. What I find interesting gender-wise about all of this is, even though this court case shows me that she was the owner of these enterprises, when it comes to taking out advertisements in local newspapers in Richmond in particular, it's called McCall's Manufactory, McCall apostrophe S, not McCall's and then apostrophe, meaning it's either the dad's or the daughter's manufactory, right? Mm. And it is technically owned by Catherine, but many of these ads are ultimately like taken out, and it says in the corner, like, by Archibald McCall. So I think her dad is the male face of this proto-industrial enterprise, but she ultimately is the owner and manager behind the scenes, which is what I can find through court case documents. But anything public-facing is very male. Gendered.
What is, and I realize you're not done yet, but so what's the takeaway? What is studying female slave owners and women business, basically women business practices or female practice, business practices? What does it tell us that we don't know, that we don't know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think the first major takeaway that I think lots of early Americanists know, but not generally, more general audiences don't know, is that in Virginia, during times where slavery existed, more women than men owned slaves. That surprises people. Most people don't know that.
And I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Did you know that, Dave?
Yeah. Well, the reason why is simply because of kind of gendered property division and wills. So if you're like a mom and dad and you are creating your will for your sons and daughters, you're going to give your daughters movable goods, which is furniture and enslaved people, because they will grow up and get married to a man, and the man gets from his parents real estate and like kind of not movable
property,
right? Because he will have a wife that will move in with him, and she's bringing
with her enslaved people,
kind of like, you know, kind of like a dowry, right? And then moving in. And so on paper, at least in the tax records, more women own slaves than men. Now, what does that mean culturally?
Yeah, interesting.
It's hard to understand what it means culturally, because the picture of slavery we have in Virginia is very much this kind of male patriarch at the apex of this master patriarch business owner, plantation owner model, right? And so we think about Thomas Jefferson and a more rural plantation, and he's the owner. But there's actually many women, especially single women, if they're trying to make money, if they don't have a husband, right? They're widowed, especially at the kind of middling levels, that are owning 1, 2, 3 enslaved people and renting them out to pay for their children's school, hiring them out for 6 month, 1 year contracts. Majori Tagaki talks about this a lot in her book on Richmond, slavery in Richmond, and so that was very influential for my work. But women in particular, it's actually, women are in this interesting intersection when you think about power dynamics. So women at this time live in a patriarchal culture, right? They do not have as many rights as men do, just legally, that is true. But women are still free, and enslaved people are not. And so they still have power over enslaved people. And so how as a woman, do you navigate being oppressed through patriarchy, but oppressing others through slave ownership, right? And so one of the main arguments, main takeaways from my work that I'm trying to show is that it's women, single women in particular, who do not have the cultural capital of being married, right? Because that's seen as like patriarchal protection, right? Those women who don't have that kind of cultural capital, that marriage status, have to oppress enslaved people even further, rely on enslaved people to gain power in this society that expects them to be married. So that's generally what I'm trying to show. Of course, plenty of married women are also owning enslaved people, and there's been a lot of work done showing on I mean, George Washington is one example, but work showing how it's actually men marrying wealthy slaveholding women that gives men their cultural capital and their power.
Washington and Jefferson.
Exactly.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, I say it happened to them. Mm-hmm. So that's how they
advanced. Chose
to exploit them. And there's also kind of a class element to my work, because I'm purposely looking at these elite women, right? One of Patrick Henry's sister, she was elite, right? Martha Washington, elite. Catherine Foot McCall, largest female slave owner in Essex County. Right, so I am focusing on elite women. There's been great work done on kind of more middling working women in cities. So they own hat shops, they own taverns, right? And so they might own 1, 2, 3 enslaved people, and they're hiring out, they're renting out, and they're having multiple forms of kind of this income and like growing urban center. But I'm looking at elite women who are also profiting from urban growth, but they're ultimately kind of staying in the plantation space. And so then it's like management from afar. And also these are women that are not owning 1 or 2 or 3 enslaved people, but like over 20. Like that's kind of the measure. I'm using Stephanie Jones Rogers measures, where she says that you're a large slave owner if you're owning 20 or more. And so these are those women who are owning many enslaved people, so they have more capital. And so what choices are they making? At the end of the day, my dissertation will either show that they're making different choices than men, which is a gender argument, or maybe they're making the same choices as men, which is also a gender argument. But what I can see already with gender differences is that the public-facing nature of these women's businesses are gendered male through advertisements and through hiring male overseers at the sites of production, and having male family members kind of write to the lawyers back and forth to figure out who owes what to whom. But then, of course, privately through letters, I'm able to see that these women are running everything themselves,
sure.
Right? So another example of that is Patrick Henry's sister, so Anne Henry Christian. So after her husband dies, there's many letters that she's writing to female family members where she's saying like, oh, you know, I'm so sad, lamenting the loss of her husband. I'm so sad, and I don't know how I'm going to figure this out. Like, you know, I obviously am a lady. Like, I don't know this whole business thing very well. Oh, but then lo and behold, she'll write letters to male family members talking about, well, so-and-so is owed this debt, and I paid so-and-so this, and da-da-da-da-da. Mm. And so she's actually almost, she's kind of feigning ignorance about how the business worked, but it's very clear her husband and her worked together on this business, and she actually is quite savvy about how to pay back debts and who gets how many bushels of salt and who gets how many gallons of whiskey to pay back this and that. Mm-hmm. So she's actually quite savvy and she knows what's going on, but then there's this kind of gendered element where she protests that she doesn't know enough.
Well, that sort of, you know, fits in with lots of writings about plantation mistresses in a slightly later period, where sort of the old stereotype was that they wear hoop skirts and they were sort of divorced from the actual management of enslaved people on the plantation because of the ways in which society put them on a pedestal. But then the more people have looked at it, the more they recognize the extent to which those women, even if they're wearing a hoop skirt, are deeply invested in the minutia of managing the enslaved household, the entire plantation, oftentimes in ways more involved than their husbands might be.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's this, you know, the spheres of what's gendered female, what's gendered male, and that women are regularly, you know, retreating into a female sphere when it's convenient to them, but also then treating into other spheres when that's also in their best interest.
Yes, self-presentation is malleable, and it's a good weapon to use in a patriarchal society.
What has been the biggest challenge for you in doing this project?
The biggest challenge for me is, well, okay, I'll say it this way. So there's two different ways you can come at a dissertation. You can either say, here is this big question I have. Now let me find the answer to it by picking out certain sources, right? I had the inverse of that. I said, here's the source, 1,000 documents is your master's essay, but let's extend that into your dissertation. So taking this very rich source and extending it into an entire dissertation, you'd think would be, I wouldn't have enough material, and in fact, I have way too many directions I can go in. So that actually has been really hard about this particular dissertation is that, okay, I have this female, like slave-owning businesswoman in Virginia. She never gets married. She's super interesting. She has loyalist connections. Okay, so that's my master's essay. It's like, okay, there's other women who are like her, but where do I stop geographically? Right, there's other women like her, but where? How do I delineate what level of class of women I'm looking at? How do I know who falls into what category, and does that count for whom I'm looking at? Right, and so that has just been a process, but I've been very lucky to have other kind of colleagues in the field who say, oh, you should look at this person, you should look at this person, and then like through those suggestions, I've been able to come up with the kind of the women that I want to view through these lenses, like in Virginia. And so it's coming together here at the end, but that definitely was the hardest part, was actually reining in all the different directions this can go. Also, she's a nail owner, right? And so that is kind of how I've gotten into my second, well, Catherine Flood McCall is a nail owner. So that's how I've gotten into what will eventually be my second project, looking at penitentiaries, is because her nail manufactory in Richmond directly competed with the brand new Virginia State Penitentiary, who created nails and other goods to sell. But the very first piece of machinery they bought was a nail cutting machine. And so I'm looking at competing forms of unfree labor in the Richmond nail and kind of craft goods market, and iron goods market for, actually, it's kind of a part of one of my chapters, but I'm wanting to expand that out into southern penitentiaries. So. You know, again, we got a dissertation to write. So here are all these wonderful threads that I can follow through the lives of these women, and having to contain it has been the issue, but also has been very fruitful.
Well, I guess I mean, because Frank and I supervise a lot of people, I think we see both those trajectories a lot. So many people come in with a really good question, and mm-hmm. then they spend the time figuring out, okay, what are the sources I do to find it? And some people only figure out exactly what the big question is like the week before they submit the thing.
I'm feeling more the latter.
I was in the latter camp too. Yeah. I had a bunch of cool things I wanted to say, but what it all added up to, I didn't know until I had actually done.
It's nice that the dissertation is not a finished project, but an ongoing one, right?
All projects are ongoing projects.
Yeah, you know, definitely.
So, I mean, you came into graduate school and you had this sort of, you know, general idea. How did you get interested in Southern history and gender history in a revolution, late, early Republic context?
Yes, tell us, where are you from and where did you study by way of background?
Background.
Before UVA, if there's such a thing, before UVA.
Yes. So I grew up in Iowa City, Iowa, and I went to undergrad at St. Olaf College, which is in Northfield, Minnesota. And I was a history, English, and women's studies major there. And I had an incredible experience with an advisor professor there, where by my sophomore year, I had taken his America to 1865 survey. This is Steve Hahn, as well as his Women in Early America. I was actually the gopher for his first class ever taught on that subject. And so there was eight of us in this small class, and it just, the articles we read, the books we read, it just blew my world away, like in the best way. And so at that point, I knew I wanted, it's crazy actually, I like knew I wanted to do this. And so I asked him to be my advisor, and then we did research together, and so kind of my undergraduate experience really, really helped prepare me for graduate school and kind of pique my interest in women's history in America in particular. So anyways, I did 4 years at St. Olaf, and then by my fourth year, I thought I really would like to get a PhD in early American history, but I've never like lived in a big city or worked. So I decided to take a little break from academia by moving to New York City. So I worked in higher education publishing in New York City for 2 years. I had a lot of fun, great city. But then I still felt the need to come back to early American history. Mm. So then I applied and ended up at UVA, and I've in my sixth year now. I'm very happy. So yeah, it's been great. And I purposely did not apply to any schools in New York City. Not because they're not great. They are. It's just that I could not have imagined going from working my 9 to 5 and going out every like other Tuesday to just then spending my life in the library in one of the biggest, most beautiful cities in the world. So I wanted to move to somewhere where the culture was studying or in graduate school and school. So like living in Charlottesville as this college town has been perfect. It's been wonderful.
But in answer to David's question, how did you make the turn to Southern history?
Southern history. So that was not a turn I made really until after my master's essay, because I had worked on this Catherine woman in Virginia. At first, and you might be able to see this on my CV, at first I thought I was going to do a broad comparison between these types of women in the North and South. So like elite women who are not owning slaves, but owning like proto-industrial businesses in the North, versus the same in the South who are owning slaves, and then using slavery as the difference and thinking about that. But that is such a large, unwieldy, wonderful project for the far future, for maybe a better dissertator than I. But I decided, okay, I should keep this to the South. And then after a little bit of work, that was too unwieldy. It's like, okay, I need to keep this to Virginia. So, and being at UVA and being in Virginia, my archives are there. It's easy to travel, especially to Richmond, for the Library of Virginia. They have huge holdings on these very interesting women. And it's just so rich. There's so much to be said and learned and written about with like Virginian slave owning women who are quite elite and are also owning businesses. There's so much to say in Virginia alone that I felt that was a better focus than kind of going beyond.
So I think there's a real advantage to doing that when you're in graduate school, when resources are limited and all other kinds of things, to pick a topic that allows you to do things within 100 miles of grad school.
Yeah, which I did not expect, because I had definitely traveled for other grants to other states.
And you traveled here.
And then I traveled here, but this is actually relates directly to someone in Virginia, so this totally counts, yeah.
I've got a question about Charlottesville, but before we get to that, your trip here, your research trip here, What's it been like?
Yeah, surprises. Sure. Yeah. So I'll say, so I was in London first, the National Archives, then Glasgow at the Mitchell Library, and then here for the National Records of Scotland in Edinburgh. And in London, Catherine had a will in London, so I got to see that, which means she had some property in London. So I'm interested to read more about that. Obviously, in these trips, you're just there, like, taking as many photos as you can, and you're going to, like, digest later. But I know that I got her will, which is really exciting. And also, I'm going to write a chapter on widows who are seeking compensation from the Loyalist Claims Commissions, right, who lived in Virginia. So I'm actually very interested how these single women, their widows, right, are asking for property back, which of course includes enslaved people. So that will be a whole other section. So I've gotten lots of those, which is great. I'm going to try to go back tomorrow morning to get some more when I fly out tonight. But yeah, and then what did I get at the Mitchell Library? The Mitchell Library is really good. I got more information on Archibald McCall and his kind of contacts in Glasgow before he moved to Virginia. Then here in Edinburgh, I've gotten more information on Samuel McCall, which is Archibald's dad and Catherine's grandpa. He was a dean of guild. He wrote a letter to the president of Ireland one year, so he actually was quite wealthy. And of course, this kind of goes into wealth begets wealth and generational wealth, even though I think it's actually quite interesting for Catherine, like what happens to second generation loyalists, right? Where she's the daughter of a loyalist and she was too young to be called a loyalist at that time. But and then of course, you know, coming back and getting your property back and then reintegrating into elite society, it's the elite part of that that makes that possible, right? And so kind of just trying to generally trace family wealth and inheritance patterns to figure out how the heck this woman ended up with Virginia and slaves when her father came from Glasgow, right? So it's just this interesting story. So yeah, that's what I've been over here doing.
Have you sensed that or felt that the kind of archival culture or the behavior in archives is different in the UK than it is in the US?
Well, that's a good question. I think people are a little friendlier in archives here.
Really?
Yeah. I can't say this, I don't know if I should say this, but I can't say archivists are the most friendly people, but then again, they've gone into a line of work where it's not okay to be talking very loudly, so maybe they are really friendly, we're just all quiet.
I think you need to meet different archivists, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, everyone's been quite friendly. Archive culture, honestly, I haven't found too much that's different. I have not been allowed to take pictures of some things here, whereas that's pretty common in the United States. But also, we're looking at really old stuff over here, so it's understandable.
Why is that? Because of they're worried about the damage to the documents?
But I also think a lot of the really old stuff is owned by others, and so they're on loan to these archives, and so, you know, they don't want pictures taken.
I guess that's trouble for lots of archives. The provenance of where these collections came from has been lost in the past 2 centuries.
Mm-hmm. So you referenced living in Charlottesville, and many people here, I mean, as you know, I've spent a lot of time in Charlottesville, not as much as you, but I know pretty well. And certainly when I talk to people in the UK, they used to not know what I was talking about or think I was talking about Charlotte in North Carolina. Mm, right. They've now heard of Charlottesville, but they've heard of Charlottesville because of the events in August of 2017. Were you there then?
I was. I was actually at the rally.
Right. Can you, I mean, if
I don't mind
if,
at all.
If you don't mind, share that kind of living history experience.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So my partner and I decided to go down to the rally that day to protest against the neo-Nazis that had invaded Charlottesville. And
this, of course, by way of background for our listeners, this, of course, was the so-called Unite the Right rally. Was that it?
Yes. So real basic background on that is that Charlottesville voted to remove the Robert E. Lee statue that was in a public park in Charlottesville. And so that actually ultimately did not happen because it started to get caught up in legal issues like, oh, okay, well, it's a state park. Does the state own it? Can you vote to remove it? Is that legal? Right. So there's already some issues there, but Charlottesville had voted to remove it. And once word got out that they even made that vote, then there were these KKK neo-Nazi kind of enclaves around the nation that created the Unite the Right rally as a response. So they are pro-white supremacy, right? And so Robert E. Lee represents white supremacy to them. And so they wanted to protest Charlottesville's decision to remove it. So that's why they were there. So what was interesting about this is that the language used to describe the two opposing parties there was interesting, because they're the protesters and we were the anti-protesters or the counter-protesters. When usually when you're hearing protesting, you're thinking of protests that might be a little bit more kind of in the progressive way, like they're protesting something bad happening, right? But these were neo-Nazi white supremacists protesting the removal of a white supremacist monument. So it was the counter-protesters who were trying to say, no, that's not right, and white supremacy is bad, and you should not be walking around with AK-47s in our town openly in a threatening way. So that language, I think for the media's sake, protesters and counter-protesters, is very confusing for people watching, like, who's who, right? But yeah, being there was scary. I took film. There's SWAT teams everywhere that eventually pushed some of the crowds just elsewhere. The police force was outgunned by neo-Nazis. So
literally.
Mm-hmm. And that is actually one of the reasons why the police chief stepped down, because that was revealed. He basically told, I mean, don't quote me on this, you know, but he told the police force to not really break up violent acts. And so they didn't.
You hear the Scottish police outside. Yeah, right? Yeah. You're probably hearing a siren.
So that an independent investigation of how everything was handled really damned Charlottesville City Police for not being properly prepared for how many open carry, just how many guns were going to be in public, and also for not taking seriously the threat of violence that was online in preparation for the Unite the Right rally. So there was lots of evidence of these, like, you know, neo-Nazi chat rooms saying, we're gonna kill, we're gonna incite violence. And yet Charlottesville allowed the permit to go through and allowed the protest to happen. And you'll notice after Charlottesville, there was lots of other planned KKK rallies that suddenly the cities were not allowing those permits to go through because they did not want literal blood on their hands like Charlottesville has with Heather Heyer, who was the counter-protester who died because James Field ran a car into a crowd. So my partner and I left 30 minutes before that happened. But yeah, I mean, I just remember shouting shame in the faces of Nazis who were bearing the Confederate flag symbol and large guns and camo gear, even though they were not associated with the military. So it was an upsetting day, obviously. More upsetting for Heather Heyer and her family and those who loved her. But the whole incident was upsetting and surreal to be witness to.
What was the aftermath like locally? Because, of course, there was a major international story and President Trump's
good
people
worse.
On both sides stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it was a story globally. But on the other hand, how did that feel? How did people react to that? I mean, obviously it resonated with you in a different way.
Yeah, of course. Locally, in the immediate aftermath, there's a lot of phone calls between family and friends. Everyone who was there, are you okay? Are you safe? Like, what's going on? Also confusion, like, what's going on? Even though you saw it on the TV, it was like, I just don't think people quite understood why this is even happening and why in Charlottesville. And so I think it was very important for Charlottesville citizens to also kind of explain to people outside of Charlottesville, like, this is not us, damn it. This is actually other people coming in into our city and doing this. Like, we are not the ones who are promoting the Robert E. Lee statue or white supremacy. It's the others who have come in from around the nation. Because then people were saying, well, it's just Charlottesville, this like hotbed of racial, division. And the answer is yes and no, right? No, in the sense of the Unite the Right rally did not happen because of anything kind of spark in it besides the Robert E. Lee removal. But of course, Charlottesville had to face itself as a city, right? Charlottesville does have racial issues. And in fact, I think if there could be a silver lining from the Unite the Right rally, which is, there barely is a silver lining, let's be honest. But if there is one, it made Charlottesville citizens turn inward and say, oh, we've been ignoring the voices of Black people in our community. We've been ignoring what people have been saying about redlining and gentrification in our city. And so, okay, Charlottesville, to be very honest, Charlottesville is a limousine liberal city where, of course, they're going to, you know, vote blue, but they don't want to talk about gentrification. And they're going to be pro-choice, but they don't want to talk about zoning laws. So very much that, but I think that has... I think the Unite the Right rally made our city look at ourselves and say, like, what have we done wrong? And hopefully we're trying to change that.
What did it mean for you as a historian? You know, so this was clearly a significant event that you lived through, as opposed to the kind of things we write about.
Sure,
right?
Yeah.
So you experienced it as a historian, but you also experienced it as a University of Virginia student. But it's because, of course, the night before, the day after, there was the torchlit rally around, at UVA, and the neo-Nazis went to UVA first.
Yeah.
Do you have any perspective on that?
Sure, it's one thing to write about history, it's another thing to live it. When it wasn't like when we were there, it was like we even had this realization of like we are in, like, what we're experiencing will be written in a textbook someday. Like, we just had no idea, even though you're like, yeah, okay, on the grand scale, you know, this is a part of history. Every day is a part of history, though, right? So to be a part of that, I think I had more appreciation for the people I write about who have lived through tense and horrid and good times. Just thinking about them as people rather than just people that I'm trying to get at, right? Trying to get at their emotions, trying to get at their motivations in life. But there's still a distance from your characters when you're writing about them as a historian, because they're long dead, right? And you're trying to understand them, but they're ultimately living in a time and place you don't understand. You can read as many books as you like. You can try to understand the cultural, social, economic, gender kind of realities of that time period in the past, but you ultimately don't know what exactly it was like. And you don't know the subtleties of the culture, and you don't know the emotions expressed unless they were written down in a letter. What about everything that wasn't written down? And so that's ultimately something that's like kind of the yearning heart of the historian, right? It's like, oh, we can try so hard to understand them, but like at the end of the day, we don't know everything. And so being a part of that kind of in Charlottesville, it's like they're not going to be able to historians in the future aren't going to be able to capture every individual's experience that day. What about the person who was video camera, like who's taping everything and got punched in the face by a Nazi, right? His story is going to be different from someone who looked and witnessed everything outside their balcony versus a person of color who's protesting versus a white person who's protesting. And so unless you're writing those things down or unless it's recorded, it's hard to capture each individual's experience and reaction to this event. So whatever is written about in the future ultimately will probably be more summarizing and more homogenous than the reality. So that was something I probably took away from it. That's just what I'll say. Yeah.
Very interesting. Thank you. What about the UVA connection?
The UVA connection. That really didn't factor into my experience, to be quite honest. The only thing I can really say about that is UVA has had a hell of a 5 years in the press with a lot of things going wrong that are actually don't have much to do with UVA in general. We have the unfortunate murder of Hannah Graham. Was my first year. She was an undergraduate student. Then we had the Rolling Stone article, a rape on campus. Sure. That was later retracted. And then there's a lawsuit, a part of that. That was obviously scandalous. Then we have poor Otto Wambeyer from North Korea who has passed away. He was a UVA student. And then, of course, we have Nazis on our campus in August 2017, right? And then in our city. So It's just been a rough few years for UVA, but I think being a graduate student there is different than being an undergrad. Like,
yeah.
And I wasn't raised in Virginia, and so, you know, I have a lot of love for UVA, but it's ultimately my employer, and so I didn't really feel that me being there meant anything to my UVA identity at that being at the actual rally.
Yeah.
Personally, I can't speak that for everyone, obviously, but just personally. It was more about being there to show solidarity with fellow Charlottesville citizens. Yeah.
I don't know whether you heard this, but a week and a half ago, somebody spray painted 1619
yes,
on the Lee statue.
That, yes.
In Charlottesville.
But then that was cleaned away.
But I think somebody got vandalized.
And then it got vandalized against the faces, some of the edifice, like faces carved into the edifice on the pedestal were knocked off.
Right. You know, and this is an interesting place where the statue is in like.
Mm-hmm.
Four or five historical moments simultaneously
mm-hmm.
being pinned to
mm-hmm.
the beginning of enslaved people arriving in Virginia
mm-hmm.
in 1619.
Mm-hmm.
It's about Robert E. Lee and
mm-hmm.
the mid-19th century. It's about the early 20th century when the thing gets put up. It's about today,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Well, but about today with reference to 1619.
Exactly.
And about today with reference to 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And so it's like there's
right.
ways
we're,
in which...
We're living in the midst of the battle over historical memory of the Civil War. And like being in Charlottesville, you're living that every day.
Oh, to be sure.
Yes. And I taught a class this summer, America to 1865. And so a part of that, I made sure to kind of take my students out into Charlottesville.
Mm.
So if we're learning about America to 1865, which includes slavery throughout all of those years, then Charlottesville is actually a great place to have that history come alive. So I had my students take just a tour of UVA, like a student tour, which they probably wouldn't have done unless they were a prospective student.
Mm.
And so that focused on Jefferson's slave owning and the slaves that built UVA. As a place, so that was good. And then I also had a scholar named Elizabeth Klesinski from the Jefferson School of African American History in Charlottesville come and give us a lecture outside as we sat underneath the Lee statue. And so about Reconstruction in Charlottesville and what happened to the African American families in Charlottesville after the Civil War, right? And so just sit under the Lee statue and talk about how hard life was for African American peoples during the Civil War, after, as we know, while having this literal pedestal put up to a slave owner, I think was very poignant, and that was the point, right? To show you we're still living with the legacies of white supremacists and those who wish America were great again for white people. So.
Mm.
Interesting. Well...
I just wanted to know a depressing note. But I just wanted to. Yeah, well, I mean, we're historians, so depressing notes, I guess, are what we'll
do
better.
Yeah, right.
But I don't know if we had a chance to mention this, but you had the chance last night to kick off our American History Workshop, which we're immensely grateful to you for.
Sure, thank you.
For those listeners who don't know, we've got a workshop that runs most Thursdays here where we bring in historians, sometimes local historians, sometimes historians from around the world to share their work with us. And thank you very much for coming to share your work with us last night and for talking with us today.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. This has been such an honor. Thank you.
Yep. Our pleasure. Thanks, Alexi.
Thank you. Bye.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.